70 on Minnesota Campus Compact. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here today. I think my first time in this particular committee. I have before you Senate File 570, and if you'll maybe take a, it's a very short bill, and I might just run through it very quickly. But in 2010, there's an allocation of $240,000. In 2011, an additional $240,000 appropriated from the general fund to the Minnesota Office of Higher Ed for grants to increase the community campus collaboration service learning statewide. These appropriations must be used for operations of the Minnesota Campus Compact, grants to member institutions, and grants for member institution initiatives. At least half of the grants under this section must be made for projects that promote economic recovery. And for every dollar in state funding, grant recipients would contribute about $2 in campus or community-based support. For 14 years, the core of the Minnesota Campus Compact, so this is not something new, has their work has been developing leadership to advance public purposes of higher education. And fulfillment of this mission requires partnerships between campuses and communities. And actually, there are four strategic goals of the Campus Compact to increase higher education's commitment to civic engagement and civic leadership. And as a civics teacher for 25 years, I think it's pretty important. Secondly, cultivating collaborative leadership around the civic mission of higher education among leaders across systems and types of institutions. Three, expanding educational opportunities for low-income students, students of color, first-generation college students, by increasing the number and quality of campus partnerships with K-12 schools and supporting efforts to make higher education more affordable. And fourth, using civic engagement to improve higher education's graduation rates for all students, especially low-income students, students of color, and first-generation college students. At a time when tough economic times place an added burden on our communities and our public and private colleges, I think this small allocation, which provides a great dividend return, is really essential. And I have with me two testifiers. On my left, I think you'll go first, Judith Romali, president of Winona State. And on my right, Tom O'Connell. He's a professor at Mankato State University. Metro State. So, have you got a promotion or not?
Well, I won't go into that.
So, Judith, I'll let you go first.
Thank you, Senator. I am Judith Romali. I'm the president of Winona State University, but I am here as chair of Minnesota Campus Compact. I'm also here to present an administrative perspective that I think will nicely jive with a faculty perspective. My main message is that this grant program has set in motion some remarkable dynamics on our campuses. All of us have capability. All of us have creative people. All of us care about the communities we serve. But the daily work of an institution to ensure that we offer effective instruction, that we maintain our campus environments, that we attend to the basics of a good educational experience often don't leave us either time or opportunity to open up new kinds of collaborations and partnerships. I want to give you an example of one of these grants that my own institution received last year. It was to develop about an eight-way partnership to study water, water quality, availability of water, water in the environment. It had a number of elements that brought in the arts, brought in the sciences, brought in a variety of organizations that are interested in the Upper Mississippi River. But what it set in motion was, at the same time we received that award, I signed the president's climate commitment for sustainability, which is a national model of colleges and universities seeking to be workable laboratory environments for environmental sustainability. And the thing took off. The focus, the activity connected up, and before I knew it, my institution had become a major focus for environmental interests in Winona County, and in southeast Minnesota. And in fact, now our next thematic move will be sustainable food sources. And by the time we're done, it'll be sustainable communities entirely. So what we've demonstrated is partnerships don't just happen. Collaborations take time and trust to develop. It takes energy and skill. It takes the kind of external recognition and support that Minnesota Campus Compact has been able to provide. But in addition, it is a remarkable leverage. As you think of all the issues affecting Minnesota and the need to invest in people in order to invest in the state, Minnesota Campus Compact has a way to link up all those other investments, whether it's in healthcare, because we have a chance with the growth of the VISTA program nationally to bring in more VISTA volunteers to work with communities all over the state in accessible healthcare, in environment, in preparing young people for college, and in working now in economic recovery on ensuring that we have an opportunity for all of our institutions. There are about 22, 23 of them across public and private sector, small and large, and where I show you a map, literally all over the state. And so we are a living fabric of people devoted to preparing our students for professional life in Minnesota. Minnesota Campus Compact, using the Campus Community Collaboration and Service Learning Grant, actually has leveraged that initial investment over a couple of decades to the point where we brought in $4.5 million of additional investment. And I wish I could say this of my other fundraising efforts. Only 9% of the total investment you have made actually was used to manage the program. Every other dollar went directly to the programs themselves. Now, in fundraising, a 12 to 15% would be considered remarkable and very rare. 9% is beyond belief. Mm-hmm. Finally, I would like to point out that the whole effort of making these funds available builds on every other investment that this state is making, but it will also ensure that economic recovery, which starts with people, will also be advanced. Each of our institutions is developing the capacity to work with community groups in different parts of the state, in greater Minnesota as well as in the Twin Cities. The capacity for that, the infrastructure for that, the pedagogical strategies that promote that, the design of the curriculum that allows for that to be a meaningful part of professional development, all are part of the agenda of Minnesota Campus Compact. This is truly one of the best investments you can make in the future of Minnesota, and I'm pleased to support this bill and to tell you that my own institution has felt the significance of this and has been able to return on that investment severalfold, even in the year and a half we've had this particular grant. I thank you for your prior support. I encourage you to give serious attention, particularly in these troubling times, to maintaining the human spirit as well as the value of Minnesota Campus Compact to the state. Thank you.
Well, thank you, President Romilly. Are there any questions for our president, Senator Erickson Robes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a special note to welcome President Romilly. She's the president of Winona State, so I've had the pleasure of knowing her for several years. She's relatively new in the job, a couple years, and she's already doing remarkable things in Winona. But Senator Sharon, to your conversation we've had in the past about healthy communities, I think this relates really well, and we heard President Romilly reflect the concept of partnerships and building healthy communities. And Winona is really a remarkable place in that Winona State has been a key player in many different collaboratives and partnerships down there. But President Romilly, could you give me an example of, we heard from Senator Dollar, maybe Senator Dolly could answer to the four targets of the grant, or the four goals, is civic engagement, collaborative leadership, expanding opportunities for low-income students and different populations. Could you give me an example of an initiative that the compact has accomplished?
Madam Chair and Senator Ropes, I'd be delighted to pick a part of the state other than Winona, since I've already given. Let me just I've got the list here. Let me arbitrarily pick something you might not have expected, which is how we are pursuing the idea of community investment. This actually comes from McAllister and represents a wonderful example of what we're doing. The idea was that institutions are physical places as well as intellectual gatherings. And we invest in goods, in services. We invest in the communities around us. Many of our institutions go into joint public-private partnership efforts. And so McAllister has developed a way to create an investment strategy that builds small business and small business owner opportunities. And we hope to spread that. It's unique in the country. Minnesota has been a leader in campus compact for a long time, and this is one I think will spread from Minnesota to a national network of all of the state campus compacts. It's a perfect example of protecting jobs, ensuring the stability of small communities as well as small businesses and large ones. And it happened as a result of one of these grants.
Thank you. Do you have another testifier, Senator Dahl?
Tom O'Connell
from Metro State.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the committee for this opportunity. I'm Tom O'Connell. I'm a faculty member at Metropolitan State University, right east of here. And I've been a faculty member for 25 years. And prior to becoming a faculty member, I worked for about 10 years in South Minneapolis as a, I don't like to use the word community organizer in the most specific sense of the term because I never was, but worked very closely with community organizations on issues of affordable housing, neighborhood development, those kinds of issues. So it was a real delight for me to have a chance to work at Metropolitan State University, in particular when Metro State moved up from our offices on 7th and Robert, downtown St. Paul, up to the east side, taking over the old St. John's Hospital. And for the first time, we had a neighborhood. And so for an old community organizer to have a neighborhood to work with as well as a faculty position, I was in hog heaven. The gist of what I want to say and make three or four points about really run parallel to what the president said, which is the campus compact has played a huge role in supporting the development of a culture of civic engagement at Metropolitan State University and across the state. It provided us both with physical and, or I should say, economic resources, but also, and more importantly, intellectual resources to build a culture of civic engagement. And I want to elaborate that in a minute. But I actually want to start by saying how lucky we are to have Dr. Ramilly as a president here in our state university system. Portland State, where she was previously, was really the model for a civically engaged urban university. I made a couple, and I really use the term pilgrimages to Portland State. I don't think there's a university of the country that more fully integrated throughout the curriculum from top to bottom a model of education that serves the community. And when you drive into Portland State downtown, they have that wonderful banner that says, knowledge that serves the city. I've been trying to get Metro State to put one up. I haven't been successful yet. But whether it's knowledge to serve the community, a city, or knowledge to serve the countryside, it really is that connection between what we do in institutions around knowledge and how that links back to communities. So three points I want to make. First of all, from a faculty perspective, I just want to reiterate how important an ally Campus Compact has been in providing an impetus for engaging faculty in this kind of work. That involves everything from learning how to take a class and create meaningful civic engagement opportunities to how to build a professional career around integrating your work in the community with your research, with and for community members, and with your teaching, so that you can get promoted and tenured, which is an issue for us in faculty, to working at the department level to help departments figure out how does my department as a science department or math department or easier a political science department, I'm in a social science department, factor in civic engagement? Where does that fit? And what you'll find is, with the help of Campus Compact, it fits in many different places. And one of the things they did over the years is run discipline-specific workshops to help psychologists and mathematicians and artists and writers and political scientists and psychologists to figure out what their role could be in this larger issue of civic engagement. And that has been really, really important in supporting my role, which has been one of the kind of, at one time it had a formal role in being the faculty support for our Center for Community-Based Learning. I want to talk about something else, the role of presidents from a faculty perspective. Whoever created Campus Compact, I think, was a genius, because what they did was create a peer group of presidents, each who were supporting each other in learning how to do this, each who were involved in some friendly competition with one another, and each which saw, I think, in a very positive way, the relationship between being out front on civic engagement and their own leadership as presidents. And you can probably back me up much more eloquently than that. Our president before last, President Bradshaw, was actually the chair of Campus Compact. And that was a huge, huge important thing for us as faculty member, because we could count on him for support. And we could help him learn and grow into that area, and he could bring back information and support that way. And whenever, wherever President Bradshaw would go, there would be this phrase that he would say in relationship to Metro State. And I don't know what the phrase is in your campus, but it was Metro State and unwavering commitment to civic engagement. I actually got tired of hearing it. But it was something that he meant. It was something that he saw as critical to our image as a university. It was something that he took when he was out fundraising. And it was something that he played back to faculty members as we were figuring out what we were doing. So that role of peer group with presidents has been, it's been huge. Now I want to talk about resources just for a second, and money and its relationship to social capital in a university setting. Campus Compact was critical to the development of our Center for Community-Based Learning. Most campuses now have, and it wasn't true 15 years ago, some sort of official place where there's staff responsibility for this relationship between civic engagement, community organizations, and the academic enterprise. The seed money that started that came from Campus Compact. I just came from a meeting of the Dayton's Bluff Urban Partnership. Dayton's Bluff is a neighborhood that we are a part of up on the east side. That partnership in different forms began with a Campus Compact grant. And now 15 years later, it remains a tremendous sort of resource for seeing that the development of the university and the development of the community is hand in hand. And we hope, frankly, that we will be able to apply for yet another grant from Campus Compact to seed some work that goes around the theme of dealing with economic hard times, particularly in our community, mortgage foreclosures and economic development, how you link a university in with those themes and how we link our students and faculty in with those themes. So Campus Compact has been an important economic resource, but the leverage that you mentioned is really critical. Campus Compact grants are fairly small, but I would say, and I should have counted them up, I'd say at least 100% or 10-to-1 ratio in terms of money that we've leveraged from Campus Compact. Getting that infrastructure started enabled us to get a grant from the Office of University Community Partnerships for HUD to work on the east side. Getting that office started enabled us to get funds from the Local Initiative Support Corporation for over the last 5 years, providing training for folks of color who are largely unrepresented in inner-city development organizations to become leaders and now employees of a whole host of those organizations. We have over 75 folks of color from the new immigrant communities as well as traditional communities who are now actively employed as leaders in neighborhood organizations, in community development organizations. That wouldn't have happened. It wasn't funded by Campus Compact, but it created the leverage for those. Now, I think Campus Compact is still important for reasons.
Mr. O'Connell, may I ask you to be targeted in your comments? We have a long agenda,
okay.
And I failed to say in the beginning, I'm sorry, that we need to condense.
I was going
to
read
this,
it,
so.
And it would have been shorter. Okay.
Yeah.
So
I'm sorry to interrupt
you,
but
thank
I need to
you.
Move
thank
the committee
much.
Forward.
I really respect that. I just want to say that this nature of this work isn't something that gets started and then it's finished. That it's hard work. New faculty get hired, new presidents come, new staff. There's a constant need for training and retraining. There's a constant need for keeping on and keeping on. And I think not only is the work of Campus Compact continues to be important, as we enter this new period in our lives and in our economies, it's even more important. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that for every dollar that the state puts in, you're expected to put $2 in of other sources. Where is that money coming from now?
Madam Chair, and I can't see your name, Senator.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I apologize, Senator Roebling. From a variety of sources, in our particular case, it came from donors who give us money to our foundation to support faculty, student research, and community work. And for that reason, most of our efforts at MATCH come from private gifts. We have, however, in a couple of instances, connected it to other grants that we have received from either state or national sources. So it's quite a mix for each institution. In the case of the example I gave of McAllister, they put $500,000 of their own operating budget into a community bank and then proceeded to leverage it with the bank's assets to invest in local community development. So there are as many different ways as there are institutions. What it does is create a much more effective and creative use of whatever discretionary funds we have, because we can expand them and focus them and then share the results. By the way, ours is a community of learners improving our world. There's a point at which Campus Compact is there when you need to have the focus and to gain the attention. It's a very powerful model.
Thank you, President.
Does it answer your question?
Thank you, President Romali. Are there further questions? Senator Roebling?
Thank you. And I happen to like Campus Compact, but I have the governor's bill that I'll be presenting later, and it has a fairly significant proposed cut in the funding. If that were to occur, what impact would it have on the program? Are there other sources of revenue that the institutions might be able to draw from to keep it going? Would some base money for administering it be enough to help move it forward with other private dollars?
President
Romali. Chair and Senator Roebling, in fact, for a couple of years, it would be possible to build on the momentum we have now and take advantage of the federal stimulus package. Of course, as you all know very acutely, that package disappears in 2 years. But there is money in the package for student support, for community engagement, for example. So already having things in motion, we could use some of those funds to maintain our effort. Beyond the next biennium, however, we would have a great deal more difficulty because we wouldn't have the federal stimulus dollars available. But there is provision for community engagement, for support for volunteer as well as collaborative models in that package. And so if we have to have a reduced budget, we could sustain the effort for up to 2 years. Beyond that, we would be in very serious difficulty.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
We'll move the bill.
Before you do move the bill, I would just like to ask, I noticed that in the request that the grants for 2010, the actual grant allotment of the $240,000 is about $125,000, and the administration is $115,000. I see that Mr. Scheibel is not here. I think my question is best
directed.
He is here,
respond,
perhaps.
Madam Chair, if you would wish.
I'll make the
aren't you? Yeah.
I can.
I'll move.
That would be great if he could come forward. Interim Executive Director of Minnesota Campus Compact. So we're looking at that a significant portion of the grant of the $480,000, that about $230,000 of it is in administrative costs.
Madam Chair, the 2 years ago, the last biennium, there was $200,000 for program from the legislature. So you could say that was an administrative cost. It isn't administration that extra dollars will be used, as Tom and President Romali described, to do training. One of the great opportunities, as the President said, is yesterday the National Service Bill was passed, increasing Learn and Serve grants. There will be more VISTAs and AmeriCorps. We are right now working with campuses to place people to work on those issues at campuses. So it's not I wouldn't describe it as administrative. I would describe it as other program dollars to leverage federal funds and other funds available on our campuses.
When you're talking about other program dollars, that it is defined as a part of the 240 that you're requesting, that 125 is administrative. I'm trying to get a sense of what that means. What is the what is defined under your term of administration?
Well, under the administration, the other dollars, it would be to we convene coordinators, the people and faculty on campuses, as Tom described, about how do you integrate and work service learning into a curriculum. We bring together and bring in speakers and experts in the field to talk about how we go to another level of civic engagement on campuses. So it's used for speakers, it's used for training, it's used for meeting rooms and things like that for us to carry on the program.
Thank you. Is there any further question? I think Senator Erickson Ropes wanted to move the bill, and
yes,
we'll lay it over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Is there any? I guess we don't have to vote on that, do we? Okay. The next bill is Senate File 14. Yes, thank you very much. Senate File 1493. Senator Skoy is here. This is Higher Ed Student Grant Program Modifications.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coring.
Can I ask a question? Now, that bill was heard and laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Who will make that decision that if it'll be in the omnibus bill?
The Senator Coring, the division will be making that decision.
Okay. Are we in the policy committee now?
We are in the finance.
Okay. But then will we actually, when it comes time to put the bill together, will we actually take a committee vote on whether or not this goes in there?
Yes, the committee, the chair of this committee will formulate a document and bring it to the committee for us to review and to be voted on by this committee.
Madam Chair, then the chair will decide out of all these bills what will be in the bill and then roll the bill out, and we'll decide whether we are going to vote for the entire bill or not to vote for the entire bill, correct?
No, you will, Senator Coring, I think that as is true with any bill that's presented, you'd be able to at any time give input to the process, as we always do along the way. And when the bill is heard, that and you'll have access to it certainly in a timely way, that you'll be able to make amendments or make modifications or changes. Senator Skoy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm before you today with Senate File 1493. I do need to fill in the blank appropriation line on line 12, page 1, line 12, I need to that blank. I think I can just do it orally, or it is a paper amendment's available. But I just would like to insert 44 in that so that that would read the assigned student responsibility of at least 44%.
Madam Chair, I would so make that motion.
Senator Coring moves that we add that 44% to line 1.12 of the bill is an amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, Senate File 1493 is in front of you today because the federal government has increased the Pell Grant. And I'm sure all of you know this, but the state grant backfills behind the Pell Grant. So this has allowed the state to have some additional money to distribute to students through the state grant program. And there are a number of methodologies that can be used to distribute those funds. I know there's been discussion in this committee in the past with regard to the differing methodologies. I just would like to say that this year, or in the past years, we have done a fair amount of work with regard to the LME portion of the state grant program. In fact, if I think it's law that if there is any extra money in the state grant, it automatically goes into the LME portion. So my hope this year is that we would look at other provisions or other methodologies within the state grant to distribute those funds. And that is why I'm here today to offer a couple of options that I think are very important. And would certainly hope that the Higher Ed Committee would consider. The first part of that is what is in Section 1 of the bill, and that is to reduce the student share from the current 46% to 44%. And if we as a legislature think it's a priority to reduce the amount of debt that students carry when they graduate from college, in my opinion, this is one of the best ways to do that, because it goes across all campuses to all students and reduces the amount of loans that they would be required to take off. So I would ask for your good consideration there. And then the other part of this bill is Section 2. All but Crookston of the university campuses currently are over the cap for the state grant program. And I think it's important to bring the University of Minnesota students in line with what the state grant program affords for financial aid. And so what Section 2 is doing is proposing to raise that to the average of the U of M attendance or tuition. Now, there is some discussion about whether that should or could possibly go higher to cover maybe the cost of tuition at the Twin Cities campus. But for now, in my proposal, what I'm proposing is to bring this cap up to the U of M average. And I think members of the committee that were here last year, this bill is the same as the bill that I brought last year. And I really believe quite strongly that this is a very good direction to go. And we do have between $65 and $70 million that will be in the state grant program this year, and it's because of the Pell Grant increases. Members, Madam Chair and members, I'm here with Dr. Laird of the Minnesota Private College Council, and I just want to inform the committee that this is potentially Mr. Laird's last session. He's contemplating retirement next summer. I think there's some that are trying to talk him out of that. But David's been coming to the legislature since 1972. I graduated from high school in 1972, and I'm pretty gray. So that's a lot of years of service. He's served 21 years for the Minnesota Private College Council. And during his tenure, these private institutions have done a wonderful job of graduating probably over 30% of the graduates that occur in Minnesota. And they do that, 80% of those students graduate within a 4-year time frame. And currently, at about an average cost of $1,000 a student to the state of Minnesota. Tremendous return on investment for the state under Mr. Laird's leadership. And so I'm happy to be here with him today, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Laird for some comments.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Senator. I'm David Laird, the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. And thank you, Senator Skoy. Actually, the first hearing I ever attended in 1972 was in this room. And I remember writing back to my folks that night in New York State and saying, this place is different and special. And I've always felt that. Thank you. As to the bill that's before you, I want to reiterate what Senator Skoy said about the work that Congress has done. Many in the Congress and the new administration worked exceptionally hard to make sure that the stimulus bill would include Pell increases for students nationwide. And as they did that, they expressed the intent that the increase should accrue to students in need-based aid. And there are some of those leaders who feel very strongly about that. All of us in Minnesota are presented with a once-in-a-career opportunity to strengthen our need-based grant program and at a most critical point for students, families, and our institutions. Remember, if you will, the grant program currently serves 83,000 students, which is roughly a quarter of our undergraduate students here in the state. For the changes that Senator Scoy is offering, we have endorsements from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, the Girl Scouts of Minnesota and Wisconsin River Valleys, and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and the Growth and Justice Group in Minneapolis. The origins for these proposals are the research that several of us have been doing over the years about how the need has grown for this kind of financial aid. And some of the more acute research that's been done has pointed out for the last several years that there are two distinct groups that still need some additional targeted assistance. First group are middle-income families that are right on the cusp of eligibility. You remember the state grant program in Minnesota reaches up beyond the eligibility criteria for the Pell Grant, so we do have some middle-income families that are now receiving state grants. The combination of the two recommended changes here will expand the reach into the middle-income families. And at the same time, they will reach the other obvious targeted group, which are the lowest income families and students in the state, whose numbers are going to swell this year due to family circumstances, due to layoffs, due to phased employment factors. And when we were advancing the merits of the Pell increase at the federal level, we argued with our delegation and others in Congress that this year we have three options for those numbers that are swelling our participants. We can serve their needs and ours by investing in their higher education, or they can go on the welfare lines, or they can go on the unemployment lines. Congress obviously felt that the dual investment was the best strategy for the future, and so do we. So we're encouraged by the interest in these changes. We're encouraged by the recognition on the part of the committees and the leadership that we need to reinvest the additional Pell funds, and we'll be happy to work with you through the end of the session to make sure that the targets are appropriate to the need.
Thank you, Mr. Laird. Is there any further presentations you wish to make, Senator Scoy?
Madam Chair, no. This is what we have on Senate File 1492.
Thank you. And thank you for your service.
Well, thank you.
Are there any questions? I know that we're looking at how to distribute the money that is available to us because of the stimulus, because of the actions of the Pell Grants. This the one question I might have, Senator Scoy, is that in your new language, you do set into law rather, or you set into an automatic increase in the four-year cap rather than as established in law. Would you, you leave the two institutions being established in law, which takes away then some sort of decision-making process that would be made year to year. Could you talk as to what your reasoning is for that?
Well, Madam Chair and members, currently the cap is a number that's set by the legislature.
Yes.
And that number then has to be readjusted when the tuitions go up. And I just think that it makes more sense because we're trying to keep the University of Minnesota in line with the state grant program cap. That's always kind of been the goal of setting that number, that it would be better to put a mechanism in place to do that. And I think I've carried that provision now for 3 years. And I think the University of Minnesota has worked with us on it. And, you know, you'll have to ask them what their position is. But in the past, I believe they were supportive of this mechanism.
Thank you. Are there any further? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree, I like to try and help cover tuition increases, but do you think it would give any incentive to the institutions to increase tuition, knowing that their lowest income students won't be hit very hard because the state grant program would go up accordingly?
Senator Scoy?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling's, to be honest, no. I think the pressures on our higher ed institutions to keep their education affordable for students is pretty intense. I think there's very little kind of just, well, let's raise tuition this year. At the public institutions, the political pressures from us is great. And I think at the private and the for-profit, the privates anyway, they recognize that cost is a factor when families are deciding their children's educational choices. And so they try to keep it as moderate as they can. And maybe Mr. Laird would like to respond.
Mr. Laird.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. In the case of the private nonprofit institutions, since the beginning of this program, we've had a governing mechanism in the grant program's structure so that there is no incentive for the privates to raise tuition for that purpose. Right now, the difference between the $9,800 that is the maximum grant and our average tuitions is between $98,000 and $24,000. So there's a margin of difference there for which there is no incentive to keep expanding that margin. We've always supported that. We think that is wise policy on the part of the state, and our institutions have learned to live with that quite comfortably.
Senator Scoy or Mr. Laird, whomever would like to answer, the automatic increase in the four-year cap has an implication to it, though. I'm asking you would agree, and that would be that that would automatically increase. So if there's not additional appropriations or if there is some way in which we have to reduce what we're appropriating, it would have to come from the formula that would be related to the student share or the family share or LME. So it does have, by putting this in an automatic way, it does have an impact on the other tools that we use to achieve a common goal, which is to assist and facilitate access to higher education for all institutions.
And, Madam Chair, that is true, but it also can be viewed, it would be more impetus for the legislature to fund the state grant program. And so there you can look at that two different ways.
Thank you. Mr. Laird.
Madam Chair, if I could add, this would track with what the new administration has proposed for the Pell Grant at the federal level. Rather than using a specific reference, they have recommended that the Pell Grant maximum increase each year by a factor of the CPI plus one. So they have established the mechanism at the federal level to have the Pell program increase as inflation or other factors increase in our economy.
Senator Clark?
Madam Chair, thanks. A question I would have then is why isn't this attached to the CPI? Going with Madam Chair's question about kind of the, obviously, I think everybody who sits here cares deeply about higher ed, and we would like to have a lot more resources, but this does bind us in a particular way. And I guess I'm not sure it does actually mirror that. I mean, should we be looking at CPI instead, since that's where they're going?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Let me just very quickly say that my goal would be to have the University of Minnesota tuitions not going up at the rate of CPI, but I'll let David Laird.
And just real quick
that.
Before that's answered, it's given it's been higher than the CPI. Thank you, Madam Chair. This perhaps could be encouraging higher increases as opposed to us saying, look, we're willing to be going with the CPI, but not higher than that.
Madam Chair, I know you want me to do
Mr.
this.
Mr. Laird, yes. So.
Yes. No, sorry.
The program needs a cap, which is reference to something here in the state. We've tried it several different ways. For some years, it was a reference just for the private colleges. It was a very arbitrary measure. Other years, we have had it referenced to the University of Minnesota. Other years, it's just been a naked number. The number right now is well behind what the tuition rates at the University of Minnesota are. And for the four-year programs in this state, it seems to make most sense to reference it to the highest tuition in the public sector and let it ride up if necessary. But as Senator Scoy indicates, if the tuitions at the university don't go up, then it doesn't go up.
Madam Chair.
Senator
I know
Clark.
We need to move on.
Yes.
But I guess then it's not really going in the same direction as what the new administration's trying to do, because they're just trying to make sure that we're keeping up with inflation in some way. I don't disagree with what you're trying to do. I mean, Senator Scoy and I have talked about this before, but I just think we should acknowledge that it really isn't doing the same thing.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Tomassoni?
Do we need a motion?
Yes, we do. Yeah, we need a motion to lay it on the table to be considered in the omnibus bill. Senator Tomassoni makes that motion. Is there any further discussion? Thank you very much. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much. Senator Pretner Solon, Senate File 734. This is a bill that is going to be presented today for discussion only, I understand, Senator, because it still is being held in Health and Human Services.
It is, Madam Chair, and fortunately, you have to sit through this again today. Actually, you're an author on the bill, too, so. I think we're having problems with the PowerPoint. But, Madam Chair, I can start anyways.
Thank you, Senator.
This proposal is intended to solve two problems, one that most people are aware of and one that we think you should be aware of. The first problem is the shortage of nurses, which is expected to become acute in the not-too-distant future. And the second issue is the need for a better method to ensure student mastery of the skills that nurses will need in their careers. The success of the healthcare system in reducing patient stays is having a negative impact on the ability of nursing students to have thorough clinical experiences. To address these challenges, two schools have come up with an idea that I think has merit, and that is building a new way to educate nurses through a greater use of technology. St. Catharines and St. Scholastica have identified two inefficiencies in a way that nurses are educated, and they have identified the means to improve current practice. They believe that a greater use of technology in teaching and learning can allow nursing faculty to be more effective and more efficient in their teaching. They propose to completely re-engineer their nursing education programs to take advantage of available teaching and learning technology. This proposal has significant public benefits. The two schools, which already graduate one quarter of the state's baccalaureate nursing graduates, aim to graduate 10% more nurses each year without hiring additional faculty. Also, because nursing students will receive more clinical experience while on campus, the schools will have graduates that are more ready to assume caregiver responsibilities in their first jobs. This should reduce job-related stress on first-year nurses and relieve healthcare providers of some of the education burden that they now have. The schools intend to test whether they can reduce the time that students spend at clinical sites. If successful, this may relieve pressure on medical education resources in the future. The proposal is meant as a demonstration project, meaning that a review committee of their peers will provide guidance and evaluate their work. The two schools are very qualified to undertake this type of project. St. Scholastica has healthcare programs from baccalaureate through PhD and specifically tailors their programs to prepare nurses to serve in rural settings. St. Catharines has programs ranging from associate degree through PhD, and they are very experienced at providing education to a culturally diverse population of women. They host one of the most financially and culturally diverse student bodies in the state. While it's a tough budget year for new ideas, this project has merit and does seek an innovative way to address healthcare service needs. And to present further details about this project, I have with me today Dr. Margaret McLaughlin, who is Dean of Health Professions at the College of St. Catherine.
Hello, Dr. McLaughlin.
Thank you,
and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I have the honor of representing about four people right now because the rest of my crew can't be here. So I'm speaking first for our collective presidents of both institutions and then Marty Wittrek, who's the Dean of Nursing at the College of St. Scholastica. And we'll keep this brief. First of all, just want to note, as in my presidential hat, that added together, both institutions have over 200 years of educating nurses for the state of Minnesota, so a long history in this regard, and that our founders themselves have even a longer history in serving the healthcare needs of the state. We believe the proposal itself reflects our respective institutional missions, in that it is intended to serve the underserved in our populations, both as our students as they graduate and enter the healthcare workforce, and oftentimes our students themselves who come from lower socioeconomic classes. We consider it a moral imperative for our institutions to actually address the healthcare workforce needs of the state, particularly the nursing workforce shortage, and we also consider it an essential importance to us to reduce the current educational burden to our healthcare providers, as Senator Solon has already noted. So in sum to that end, it's to build a demonstration project which is really intended to serve the needs of the state. What we wanted to do in this presentation is just give you a few moments, and some of you have heard this about the third time, I think, in the last 2 days, so could give this themselves. But the first thing to note is why we need a change in our educational model and thus the proposal, the genesis for the proposal. Traditional nursing education is an apprenticeship model. In the old-fashioned sense, students would come in, receive on-campus lectures from faculty experts, then engage in an increasing array of more complicated clinical experiences through a series of courses, and then finally, after graduation, have that education continued with help through the healthcare provider themselves. This really is a model for a different time in our healthcare delivery system. Currently, increased patient acuity that's present in our acute care healthcare settings make it much more difficult for novice students to actually work with patients without serious staff oversight. We all know that it's very hard to stay in a hospital for more than 24 hours yourselves, and so the ability to engage in continuity of care, which is important for student learning, is compromised, and that the current education model is very burdensome to our healthcare providers. And in fact, there are a number of large systems that are questioning where their commitments are and how they're actually going to be able to sustain their clinical education commitments in the current economic environment. And finally, the coming shortage of nursing, or the existing shortage of nursing faculty, as well as nursing staff, really can't be addressed just by expanding our current system models. So to that end, we've proposed building a new model of learning, which takes advantage of newly available simulation and other technologies. So it's a wide array of use of technology, which can improve student skill developments and learning while still on campus before they actually have to engage in the healthcare and clinical environment. And nurse faculty and staff can then create a very safe practice situation on campus, which serves a variety of student learning needs, particularly the diverse learner. Gives them a very safe place to practice their skills and their learning before they engage in the actual hands-on clinical learning experiences. So we propose to re-engineer our nursing education by developing new curricula that integrates these technologies, as we've said about three times now, relieves the growing educational burden on our providers. And schools, we will believe we both can educate more nurses given the same number of faculty members that we currently employ by making our faculty more efficient and effective educators and being able to increase our class sizes, which currently is defined by the number of students at a clinical site can actually accommodate. There's an array of technologies available, and the younger you are, the more familiar you are with some of these. They range from kind of this traditional simulation models, which is actually becoming an established and somewhat older technology, to the use of electronic medical record, an array of health informatics approaches for learning, the use of Second Life, which is a very popular a way of engaging student learning from different geographical locations. And finally, as Senator Solon has identified, we will have a well-defined assessment and evaluation model. We work with our nurse educators. It's a very collegial community. Both institutions have partnered in a number of initiatives in the state with our MNSCU partners and the University of Minnesota. We will engage our colleagues on other campuses as we design the model, refine the model, and then disseminate the model throughout the state. We believe it's something that is the intent is to be replicable amongst our nursing faculty colleagues. And we will share our findings with the community as well as with the healthcare providers. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there is there anything further, Senator Partner Solon, that you wanted to say?
I think, Madam Chair, just to recognize that this is a program targeted at a very specific problem that we'll be facing in the future, and that is the shortage of nurses in our healthcare industry. And this looks at, or it aims to increase the number of nurses for the same number of faculty. So,
are there any questions? Hello, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This sounds like a great thing to do. My question is, are there, if this, a lot of this technology is already available, are there other places in the country that have already done something like this that we could adopt rather than designing our own process? I guess the secondary question is, isn't this the kind of thing which ordinarily institutions would kind of find the resources internally to change their curriculum models?
For
the tape, we need to know who's speaking.
Yes, this is Margaret McLaughlin. Thank you. I'll answer the latter question first, and something I didn't know. The institutions themselves have never been before the legislature to seek resources. Neither institution has the resources to mount this kind of an initiative now. We believe it is the way to teach for the future. And to answer your first question, I think the fair answer to that is, do places around the country use technology in their learning? Yes. Does it need to be tailored and integrated within any particular institutional curricula in a certain defined ways, I think, is what we're after. I believe St. Kate's and the College of St. Scholastica has deep scholarship in how students learn, and so really taking advantage of what's available in an integrative method is very essential. As an example, Scholastica is a leader in using electronic medical record for teaching purposes. They got a Health and Human Services grant from the federal government to design that methodology for use. So in true academic fashion, what you want to do is garner the best practice that's out there and then modify and integrate it for what would be specific to the state. I think what's a opportunity in Minnesota is that there's a very close relationship between the educational entities and the healthcare providers. So really understanding the gap in learning between what we do as educational entities and then what novice nurses experience on the floor is something that we can engage in a very meaningful way that's fairly unique around the country. I've come from Pennsylvania too here. It's pretty impressive what we're capable of doing here given those partnerships.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Latz, we have tackled this problem from a different perspective, though. We do have loan forgiveness programs, and we do have career ladder programs that both programs, St. Scholastica and St. Catharines, have involved their students in the past. But this is a new way of tackling that problem and actually allowing us, I think, to get more out of our dollar invested than by loan forgiveness programs.
Any other questions? Senator Wieger. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Prettner-Solon, is there a need to re-engineer curricula technology in MNSCU? U of M, I noticed the grant is for not that part of the system.
Well, Madam Chair and
Senator
Wieger, they will be working with MNSCU, the University of Minnesota, the nonprofit colleges, plus the Board of Nursing, the Commissioner of Health, and the Minnesota Association of the Colleges of Nursing, which are all the leadership of every school of nursing in the state, as they're moving forward. And they will be reporting back to them so that if this model works, then there will be an opportunity for them to share in this technology and to also bring these programs into, or this type of technology into their programs.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Wieger.
Senator Pretner Solon, then I would assume then the nursing leaders from the university and the Minsky system, they're on board with this and they'll be looking for the results from the potential pilot to help guide them for their future plans.
Yes. This is Margaret McLaughlin again. As a matter of fact, my associate dean for nursing, Alice Swan, is meeting with Connie Delaney right now. That's why she's not here, around the whole issue of incorporating technology for learning. So we're very systematically engaged in that dialogue.
Any other questions? And I apologize for missing your presentation. The members and staff will have to fill me in. I had a bill up in another committee, and Senator Solon, the bill got laid over. So we'll need your help on Tuesday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
I guess you missed my question, but it went in part. I mean, I think it's a terrific thing needs to be done. And I guess I would just encourage the author and Dr. McLaughlin to, if you haven't already, you know, kind of survey what's already out there. And maybe the answer is there isn't any other model for delivering the kind of integrated curriculum and education that you want to deliver. And if that's the case, great. But if there is one out there, it's a whole lot cheaper to adapt it from someone else than to pay $1 million now. And in the time of a real tight budget, it seems to me this might be a good opportunity not only for us to consider it as a grant, but also to encourage all of those who would benefit from this maybe to cough up a little bit of money each to fund this effort. You know, if Minsky system and if the university and if the healthcare providers all see that there's a benefit to this kind of a development, if they all kick in $50,000 or $100,000, you can get your $1 million grant and do this or whatever the amount turns out to be. Just another option for financing. It's not going to be within our purview, you know, in this committee, I guess, to make the finance decisions. But I know how tight dollars are around here this year, and I'm trying to throw out some other ideas for you.
Madam Chair and Senator Lutz, just one comment. The dollars are mostly for actually being able to purchase the technology and to do the renovations that we need in order to use the technology. So in terms of taking advantage of other models, application of other models, that's learning that we would do. But the dollars are intended to support actually acquiring the technology we need to do that. So there's no, it's not like we're investing a lot of the money into faculty development. There's some small portion in faculty development, but most of it's investing in the technology per se.
And Madam Chair,
Senator
Latz, the reason we're before your committee is because this is an educational tool, but also there's potential for applying for some stimulus grant funds that might be available.
This is a really important issue. I hear all the time about the problems with clinical sites. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really glad that you've got some innovative ideas to address this.
Thank you.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, I'm sorry, I'm just coming
Dr.
on.
Dr. McLaughlin.
Dean McLaughlin.
That's okay.
Tail end of your discussion. But are there any other schools, I'm particularly thinking of our publics, that have made similar requests or have similar needs as are identified here in this nursing area?
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking.
Madam Chair and Senator Pretner Solon, this need for additional nursing education has been identified, and the request before us today is to give money to two specific institutions. And I wonder more broadly if there have been requests made of either the University of Minnesota or Minsky institutions in this same area.
Senator Lynch, we haven't had any specific requests, but we've certainly heard from the other nursing programs a problem with clinical sites. In fact, we just heard at a particular issue at RCTC, which I called Dr. Baer about, where they were graduating of 300 nursing students, but they only had 50 clinical sites committed. And that, you know, something has to change here, because we can't be telling students they can be nurses and then not allowing them to finish their education because we don't have
clinical sites for them. So this is definitely is a nursing education-wide issue. Senator Sharon.
I can speak to that very directly. That
who is a nursing instructor.
Yes, that the complexity of the responsibility of the nurse and the opportunity to have enough exposure in a clinical site to develop some competencies is severely restricted. And so we have to find alternative ways other than direct contact. We have to complement that with other kinds of learning experiences to make certain that when we have these graduates, they have at least a basic level of competency and self-confidence around around very, very and increasingly difficult kinds of assessment processes, critical thinking processes. In terms of the second question, though, Senator Lynch, yes, in the MNSCU system, the discussion of trying to increase investment through MNSCU in technology and in the development of this capacity is very active, but they become a part of that hierarchy of requests for dollars in the MNSCU system. So it's not that the desire isn't there or the request from the schools of nursing for or the colleges of nursing for this money to be invested in MNSCU or the public systems, but when each of those divisions put out their requests for what the MNSCU system is going to ask for, it falls someplace in a set of hierarchies. So I just want to be clear that because you haven't seen it doesn't mean that it isn't very present in all the campuses that are working with
MNSCU. Well, in some of the MNSCU institutions, at least some that we visited as a committee, like in Rochester and at Metro State, they do have virtual experiences. You know, we were over at the Metro State opening, I believe, with the committee last year, fairly close to their opening of the program. And we've seen that with the dental surface as well, where we've seen their opportunity to do a kind of a virtual experience. So technology can help. Senator Prentner-Sullivan.
Madam Chair, I'd just also like to emphasize as we keep making more and more cuts in health care and personnel and staffing go down in our hospitals and facilities, it becomes even harder for them to find placements for nursing students in those facilities because of the demands. And so using technology to help in the training becomes a way to resolve some of that issue.
Madam Chair,
Dean McLaughlin, yeah,
and Senator Lynch, I think the other component of your question would be that we're very deliberate about engaging our MNSCU partners in developing the model. So I hear the question about whether they've got similar requests. I think one of the things that we're hoping to bring to it is a pretty deep array of expertise in our own faculty about student learning that we can integrate with the application of technology that will benefit the entire Minnesota Association of Colleges of Nursing. Back to my comment that the collegiality amongst the nursing programs within the state is to our benefit in that regard.
Okay. Thank you very much, for your presentation. This bill is for us, is for informational purposes because it's still with the Finance Division on healthcare.
Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair
you.
And committee members.
Is Senator Dibble here? We have another bill, Senate File 549, that is in transportation, but it involves the University of Minnesota. So we thought we would be good for us to hear about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 549 is a bill that we bring to you. It emerges from a lot of the work and discussion that we've had over the last few years. Specifically emerges from the work done by the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group that met for the last couple of years with the task of helping the state identify strategies and policy recommendations so that we could reach our carbon and greenhouse gas reduction goals that we set for ourselves. If you recall, in the Next Generation Energy Act, we established goals to try to get a handle on greenhouse gas emissions, try to get a handle on global warming, that are pretty aggressive, 15% by 2015, ramps up in 2025, ultimately to get to 2005 levels or 80% reduction of 2005 levels by 2050. We certainly have had a lot of discussion and a lot of action taken in the energy utility sector. We have the Renewable Energy Standard, and we have the energy efficiency standards, 1.5% annual savings of energy sold, et cetera, which is great because you know, that's a place where we know we get the most greenhouse gas emissions that are emitted into our atmosphere, 34% from electrical energy production, a lot of that from coal, of course, which our state relies on more heavily than almost any other state. But that's only one of the little wedges as we put together the wedges that ultimately allow us to bring those overall emissions down. We need to be taking a look at our other activities, other sectors. The next greatest contributor is the transportation sector, and that would come in at about 24% of contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. And so needless to say, that was the focus of a lot of attention and a lot of discussion by the Climate Change Advisory Group. And most of the transportation sector contributions come from cars, you know, just us driving our cars around. And so some of the strategies they identified, of course, were fairly obvious. Increased transit, let's look to alternative technologies, flex fuel, plug-in hybrids, fully electric vehicles, those sorts of things. But it's you know, if you examine the issue, you can throw a lot of transportation, a lot of transit at this, and still not solve your problem if you're not creating an efficient, developed area to move around. And so land use becomes a key part of that. Doing travel demand management techniques with large employers, looking at possibilities for other kinds of alternative transportation, pedestrian and bicycling and that sort of thing. As a part of the work as well, over the last few years, we asked the University of Minnesota through the Center for Transportation Studies, and we'll hear a little bit more about that from Bob Johns. We commissioned an examination of the transportation sector, and I'll pass these around. You know, keep one if you want it. I only have four. It's a really good report and very easy to read, and we can get lots more. Can I borrow yours for a second? The findings of that report are very consistent with I believe informed in some ways. Is that true? The work of the Climate Change Advisory Group. And the key findings you can find in the executive summary right inside the first page. And through that examination, they found out that the transportation sector can nearly meet its entire share of Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions goal in 2015 and can exceed the goal, the next milestone we have set for ourselves in 2025, using a combination of strategies targeted to reduce fuel consumption, vehicle miles traveled, and fuel carbon content. So this bill really looks at reducing our fuel consumption, reducing our vehicle miles traveled. Probably the key policy recommendation you'll find in the bill on take a look. It's working with the Metropolitan Council in the metropolitan area, starting with section 7, 8, and 9. And just in short summary, we asked the Metropolitan Council to work with local authorities through their land use and their other system policies, our sewer policies, our land use policies, and our transportation policies, to really see what we can do to reduce vehicle miles traveled in the metropolitan area.
Senator Dibble, what are you having the Center for Transportation Studies do? Why don't you focus on that?
All right. Well, we have to use you have to describe what we want the Met Council to do, because then
because
that's where the University of Minnesota comes in. Ultimately what results is there'll be changes to our comprehensive planning, which is our major land use guides, and the Met Council has kind of the overarching authority over locally developed land use plans. They set the system policy statements and the overarching goals that we try to achieve as a metropolitan area, and then following that activity by the Metropolitan Council, our comprehensive plans at the local level are updated every 10 years following the census. One of the reforms that we've implemented in this bill, which I'm very excited about, is rather than waiting towards near the end of the decade to update our comprehensive plans, through technology and through other innovations, we're accelerating that process a little bit. So by about mid-decade, we're doing the updates to the comprehensive planning. In introducing this idea that to really reduce vehicle miles traveled and to create an intersection in our greenhouse gas emissions and transportation and land use, we've asked the University of Minnesota to engage in really developing a set of policy ideas, doing some original research, and really identifying those policy levers that would assist greatly local communities in accomplishing those goals that would be set by the Met Council. And so you'll see on Section 15, where it says transfer of money, kind of an awkward title, that really is the description of how we engage the University of Minnesota, kind of in three parts. First, we ask the University of Minnesota, working on a voluntary basis in conjunction, starting early on, to do some research and engage local units in customizing the wide array of policy opportunities that there are to fulfill this goal. See how we ask them to cater to the specific needs of the Twin Cities, et cetera. And then we would ask the university to segue into really building some capacity at the local level, working with local units of government, working with the Met Council to conduct training, create a clearinghouse, do some training, et cetera, develop a website. And then finally, as folks are updating, actually doing the actual work of updating their comprehensive plans for submission to the Met Council, be a resource and provide some technical assistance in conducting that activity. We developed this in conjunction with the University of Minnesota and the local units of government in the metropolitan area. A lot of concern was articulated. What is it you're talking about? Is it complicated? Are we going to have to hire a bunch of new staff? Are we going to be put to great expense? And we think we solve a lot of those questions by engaging the University of Minnesota and the Met Council in this way. With that, Madam Chair, I'll introduce Bob Johns from the Center for Transportation Studies, who can, with whom we helped develop this idea and this proposal, who can perhaps describe it in some more detail.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johns.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Bob Johns, Director of the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. I'll just briefly touch on three points. One, to describe a little bit of what our center does, describe a little bit past studies that we've done for the legislature, and then comment on the legislation that Senator Dibble has described. We're a relatively large multidisciplinary center within the University of Minnesota. We work to advance the land-grant mission of research, education, public service in the field of transportation. We define transportation very broadly, looking at engineering, technology, also planning, policy issues, economic issues. We work with over 25 different disciplines within the university, including outstate campus at UMD and Morris. We work with over 70 different faculty and researchers. So we have a lot of transportation research and education activities going on. We are working with our faculty to advance their academic department's mission, producing new knowledge as a major research university, and educating students. We complement that with major outreach efforts. I think many of you are on our mailing list, to try to get that information out to make a difference. We're very entrepreneurial. What makes a research university go is funding for graduate students. So we do have many state projects going on, but we really try to leverage that funding to pursue federal funding and have some major federal grants. We are considered a national university transportation center. We have done work in the past for the legislature. We don't instigate this or lobby for it, but when we're asked to do a study, we take it very seriously. I think several years ago looked at the economic impact of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Senator Dibble has referred to the greenhouse gas reduction study that we did last year. We're currently finishing a study on value capture for transportation finance. What we try to do with these studies is take a very nonpartisan approach. We don't take policy positions. What we're trying to do is produce some very objective information that you and others, all the stakeholders, can use as you create and advance public policy in the state. A big part of our study is to involve students. Our value capture study, for example, that's going on right now has 5 graduate students working on it. The greenhouse gas study had 3 graduate students. They're working with our faculty to create new knowledge. And a great benefit of investing in the university is not only are you getting the ideas and the recommendations on new practices and new findings, but you're also getting students who understand these issues, who are our future workforce. So this request from Senator Dibble is very intriguing. It does build on the greenhouse gas reduction study that he already referred to last year. But it goes beyond what we've done in the past, and it's not just a research study with a research report. It does have research. Research is very critical to it because these issues are very emerging. We want to look at research on what others are doing with these policies, you know, what are some best practices around the country, but also around the world. Europe has done a lot with their greenhouse gas reduction policies. We also want to look at the tools to measure greenhouse gas, to calculate reductions from different strategies. There's some tools out there, but we think they're fairly immature, and we want to evaluate those and perhaps customize them. And we want to actually look at the different strategies to reduce greenhouse gases from transportation planning. In addition to that research, though, there's extensive community involvement with this work over multiple years. So, you know, we anticipate involving 10 to 20 cities. There are cities in the metro area already working on these things. We would like to involve them. They're eager to be involved in trying out new approaches using the findings from our research. We would offer extensive training, extensive technical assistance. These initial communities would be sort of laboratories as they use our findings to do their comprehensive planning. And then we would build on that with extensive outreach to many stakeholders, other communities, as the other parts of this bill start to begin to be implemented. So that's what we're doing. Our goal is really to advance things at a very high level. We anticipate that our results would be a national model and that we would hope to attract additional funding at the federal level to build on our national expertise.
Thank you very much, Dr. Johns. It's wonderful to have you here and Senator Dibble here in the Higher Ed Committee. We always love hearing about what the University of Minnesota is doing. Mr. Fuller just has a technical amendment on line 11. Do you want to read it, John?
This is on page 11, and there's a number of lines where there's terminology that says they're encouraged to do this, they should do this, and in the context of an appropriation, the language is mandatory. That's our tradition. We don't say you're encouraged to spend the money on faculty salaries, or we direct it. So I think on page 11, lines 5, 7, 9, and 20, delete should and insert must. Page 11, line 10, delete is encouraged to, insert must. Page 11, line 11, delete to. And then page 11, line 29, delete is encouraged to and insert must. So essentially it changes the direction to spend money that they're encouraged to do what we want them to do, that they must do it, and that they shouldn't do it, not that they should, but that they must. And I think there's some confusion about, you know, on the autonomy issue with respect to spending. The money is received with the strings attached.
Madam Chair, I'll make that motion.
Senator Coring makes that motion, as stated by Mr. Fuller. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sendrum.
Madam Chair, and maybe to counsel, with or without money, with or without a voluntary participant here, where is the line with respect to the legislature directing the University of Minnesota to do anything? I am under the understanding that there is a line with respect to the the legislative body and their ability to
never been tested
impose
in court.
On the University of Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Fuller, set me right.
Madam Chair, Senator Sendrum, it's not black and white. There are some black and whites and there's some gray. Black and white is the court has decided that with respect to appropriations, that if they're received, the conditions of the appropriations have to be adhered to. With respect to the running of the university as an academic institution and academic policies, the more you go there, the more the autonomy is. With respect to the university as a member of the community at large, such as, the big case was falling to design standards that the state sets up, they have to adhere to those. So I think the dividing line or the tension is between the you as an academic institution and as a member of the community at large with respect to general laws. So they are subject to many general laws, but you know we couldn't tell them to offer an English course, for instance, or with respect to the operation of the institution as an educational institution and something more than that. They are autonomous. So the gray area is when you go from a member of the community at large to their academic mission, there's some cutoff in there. But it is clear that with respect to appropriations, that if money is given to them for a purpose, they either refuse the money or spend it for the purpose for which it was appropriated.
Senator Corrine renews his motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Is there any other comments on this bill? Senator Roebling.
If we provide this money, great. Will the programs for the local units of government, you've mentioned extensive training and consultation, will that be free to them, or how will that be handled?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, yes, I don't imagine that we would ask them to pay a fee to come in and avail themselves of these services.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I can understand really helping with comp plans for evolving communities, but what about fully built-out communities? How do these kinds of plans affect them? I'm puzzled as to what would be recommended, for example, for a community that's fully built out on how they could redesign their transportation system.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And that's why we want to engage the university, of course, and the Met Council. The challenges will be quite varied from community to community. The opportunities will be varied as well. It's not all going to come about through land use, per se, building, not all going to come about from building, shops near academic institutions, near employment centers, et cetera, because, in a fully built community that those redevelopment opportunities are few and far between. But there are opportunities to work with large employers on travel demand management techniques or using transit incentives or those sorts of things. So it'll be an array. I mean, the opportunities will vary from transit, better and more efficient use of transit, land use, all sorts of things. And so that's why we really need to engage local communities, so that we're customizing it to the experience of the Twin Cities, and we're really looking at different communities and different circumstances and creating a whole menu, a whole array of ideas, that folks can then choose from and plug into their policies that they adopt locally. More to add?
Madam Chair, Senator, our research plan would have a good sampling of all different types of communities, and there as Senator is indicating, there could be various strategies that are customized for different types of communities. That would be one of the outcomes of our research. But in fully built-up areas, besides the continual development that's going there, nationally there are a lot of investments being made on non-motorized transportation, biking and walking facilities. So we would need to evaluate this as well as zoning strategies. I think there would be things that would be uncovered for those fully developed
the metro area. Madam
Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I just want to ask about the Livable Communities Fund, which in the past has been used to actually put projects on the ground, and this is more of a planning and not an implementation proposal. Senator Dibble, how did you happen to pick this? It kind of goes in a different direction from where the money has been traditionally used, I think.
Thank
Senator
you. Thanks. Great question. A couple of reasons, Senator Roebling. One is this is certainly consistent with the principles and the overarching you know, rationale for the Livable Communities Fund itself. You know, and if you look to back here, there's a description of the Livable Communities criteria and guidelines on Section 10. And, you know, livable communities are about interrelating development, transit, affordable housing, employment growth areas, et cetera. In fact, we introduce the idea of greenhouse gas emissions reduction as well through VMT reduction. And so, you know, it's using some of the livable communities for planning for fulfilling those goals and objectives. At this moment, and this is, of course, you know, these are one-time uses of these dollars that will have long-lasting effects to better fulfill the goals of the Livable Communities Fund. And also, you know, in a practical sense, don't have general fund dollars that are available as well. But it's for a purpose inside the metropolitan area that fulfills, you know, well-established policy goals.
Okay. Thank you very much. We really need to move on. We have four more issues to discuss. So the motion needs to be to send the bill over to the Transportation Budget Division and Finance. Senator Clark moves that Senate File 549 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Transportation Budget Division. Any more discussion?
As amended.
Senator?
As amended.
As amended. As amended. Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you
very much. Senator Clark, 1563. Shortest bill I've seen all session.
And Madam Chair, I do have an A1 amendment that probably doubles it, but you're right. And actually, when it first got done, I was like, does this really do what I was hoping it would do? And it does. So if we could.
Did she talk to you at all?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Senator Clark moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Clark.
Madam Chair, members, we heard an earlier bill from Senator Skoy, and I know that this is something that's been on all of our minds, kind of two different things. One is, how do we make sure we're maximizing the federal dollars that are coming through our state? And then how are we also trying to deal with our budget deficit? And for all of us who care deeply about higher education and know this is the way that we really, you know, this is our economic engine. Getting our students through post-secondary education, both public and private, is critical to the future of our state. And President Obama, his, you know, the goal that was stated out there was, how are we helping families who are going to college with these growing tuition expenses at a time that we're also having to deal with budget deficits? And so the goal of this bill was, okay, how do we maximize those federal dollars in the fairest way possible? And I think there's some other really good approaches out there. I hesitated in going much broader personally than this because we don't know what the next 2 years are going to bring. We don't really know what our economy is going to be like, what the federal dollars are. I know that everybody who is getting any kind of federal dollars is sure that there's going to be ongoing dollars, but they have assured us that's not necessarily the case. So what this bill is doing is it's setting the living and miscellaneous expense allowance for the state grant program. And as you are aware, is up till 4 or 5 years ago, any excess funds in the state grant program were sent to the general fund. Now these funds remain with the state program. This bill will continue this policy. What's different this year is the state grant program will be initially funded by increased Pell Grant dollars from the federal government. This, in turn, allows the state dollars to offset living and miscellaneous expenses. And I should have done the oral amendment since I have already. I'll come back to that. It would set it at $7,100, which would be a $900 increase. This is important because it allows college students, again, both public and private, to receive aid that more adequately covers their expenses. It would keep higher education affordable as students face rising tuition at our public colleges and universities. I think many of you are aware that I've got two sons, one who went to St. John's, and the other who is at the U of M. St. Cloud itself has St. Cloud State, St. Cloud Technical College, and St. John's and St. Ben's are right nearby. They are critically important and important options for everyone. I have to admit, I am personally concerned in this recession, how are people going to afford to even be able to go to a two-year college, let alone anything else? So for reference, the governor's bill does take a similar approach. Last year, the program allotted $5,000 per student. His proposal raises that to $65,000, $72,000 in the first year and $69,000, $66,000 in the second year. And this kind of jump starts it up a bit more, Madam Chair and members. The reason for the additional language is making sure that we are having the federal funds, the Pell Grant funds, and our state grant funds going for the purpose for which we intend and not somewhere else.
Okay. Let's hear briefly from your witnesses.
Yes. And Madam Chair, do you want me to go ahead and put the number in right now on line 1.8 as an oral amendment, since I forgot to do that earlier? Madam Chair, the oral amendment would be $7,100 per year.
On line 1.8.
Yes.
Okay. We'll consider that an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Kerry Bowser, Vice President of the Minnesota State College Student Association, which represents over 100,000 community and technical college students across the state. It is an honor for me to be with you today. Students in Minnesota are fortunate to have a strong state grant program, the self-loan, and other forms of financial aid that assist them in the pursuit of higher education. We would like to thank this committee, the rest of the legislature, and the Office of Higher Education for its commitment to a strong and fair system of providing aid to students. The overall cost of higher education is growing, and the need for financial aid is growing greater every day. Students at Minnesota's community and technical colleges are paying the second highest tuition and fees in the nation, and many of them rely on financial aid to help make ends meet. We understand the significant increases in the cost and are not unique to the community and technical college sector, but believe these institutions that are located all over the state must remain points of access for all Minnesotans. When our state faces tough economic times such as those facing us today, many Minnesotans turn to our community and technical colleges for retraining, continuing education, customized training, or even an entirely new career path. But we are on the verge of making these access points inaccessible for many students. One key aspect of keeping these institutions that serve every region in this state affordable and accessible is a strong state grant program that gets dollars to the students who have the greatest needs. Thanks to increases in funding for the Pell Grant on the federal level, the Minnesota State Grant Program is projected to run a surplus, which has brought forward a number of ideas on adjustments that could be made to the program for the benefit of students in the state. It is our belief that if any changes to the state grant program are considered, they must be done with some guiding principles at the forefront of the discussion. First, students who come from low-income families or those who may have lost their jobs and are looking for a fresh start must be the main beneficiaries from a great amount of the dollars spent. Further, it is our strong belief that changes made to the program must be done in a way that is equitable to students in every sector of higher education. While we are especially sensitive to the challenges facing students in our community and technical colleges, we understand that similar hardships face all students. It is our belief that the dollars available to fund changes to the state grant program should be distributed as fairly as possible. Several years ago, many higher education constituencies came together and reached an agreement that any surplus in the grant program be shifted into the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, as it is likely the fairest way to distribute these types of dollars. It is our hope that a great majority, if not all the current surplus dollars, be added to the LME, which will help all state grant recipients regardless of where they go to school. In the end, we believe a significant increase in the LME allowance will help the grant program maintain its long-term viability as we look for ways to deal with the surplus that could be one-time money if federal funding does not materialize over the next year. Madam Chair and members, thank you again for allowing me a few minutes of your time today, and I stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Bowser, and welcome. I think this is the first time you've testified
yes,
for
ma'am.
Our committee, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Thank you
Madam
for
Chair.
Your comments. Any questions from members of the committee? Then Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Graham Allen, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota State University Student Association. I'll just make a couple quick comments of everything that Carrie said. In the past, this committee has recognized that the LME allowance increase is both the most equitable and one of the areas that needs the most financial funding increase. The Office of Higher Education estimates that the average non-tuition cost, so the LME cost for a full-time student, has reached around $10,000. So for heating, transportation, food, you know, all the costs associated with having to go to school. And the current allowance is set at $6,200. That's a substantial gap for any student that is financially needy to make sure they can go to school. So our students wholeheartedly support and urge that you use the bulk of the surplus to help all students, not just some students, but all students. And this is one of the most fair and equitable ways to do it, so we support this bill.
Except if you're Senator Roebling's children, they live really cheaply.
South Dakota, Madam Chair.
South Dakota.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
I have to admit, as a parent, it was over the last several years quite the eye-opener that even with Nathan now being at the U, that the costs of living are about as much as the cost of tuition. Even when you're trying to be hard on them about being careful with spending. So this, you know, I do believe that this is, as a parent, this is the way that you can really help all students go as far as possible. Unless, of course, you're going to South Dakota.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if it would work in this situation, but you know, there are a lot of state laws that are actually setting dollar amounts in statute. And it's always been a source of frustration to me that we have to pass a law to set a dollar amount in the statute when, at least in some of the statutes, there might be objective reference points that we could use so they could adjust or fluctuate without us having to go through the legislative process. I'm not sure if that would work well for this kind of situation. And we've already addressed one other similar idea earlier in this meeting. And we kind of see these kind of things annually. My first year in the House, we had a bill that set the interest rate for the interest that a landlord can charge on the deposit that is put down on an apartment. And that interest rate, you know, we adjust it based on all sorts of different factors, I suppose. I didn't see why we had to pass a law to do that. We should just tie it to the prime rate or whatever and let it fluctuate.
It's a debate right now in pension policy whether there should be a flat increase, which there is with some of our pension systems, of 2.5%, or a increase that's based more on cost of living adjustment, which is what pensions are supposed to do, is keep up with cost of living. You know, I think you said in the SCOI bill there was a proposal to peg the four-year cap to the average cost at the University of Minnesota. We see it in terms of what are they called, welfare payments. Those have not had any cost of living adjustment, and I think something
21,
like
20 years. Manager.
Right. So, I mean, it is a problem if you're trying to maintain the spending ability of something if you don't take inflation into account. Gas tax, another one, index for inflation. Senator Clark.
Hey, Madam Chair, I think that's a real good thing maybe over the interim. That's one of the things we should look at. The reason why the dollar, not just from a tradition standpoint, why there's a dollar amount in here is because we are getting a finite amount from the federal government at this point. And so this was an attempt to maximize those dollars. And certainly as we're going forward, whether it's CPI, something else, you know, there's lots of things that we can go to. But just given our economic times and given we know what the parameters that are coming to us, that's the reason why. But I think that what you're talking about, it's often puzzled me as well.
It's more truth. I was just talking to Mr. Albrecht about should this have a sunset on it too, because it is using a temporary bump in the Pell Grant. Now, we hope that will be permanent.
And Madam Chair, that was one of the questions I would have for you and for our committee members. I mean, I would like to see it become permanent, but I also recognize that we will have finite funds, and obviously if we keep it at this number, that would mean something different in the future in terms of the number of students that could use it.
Mr. Fuller said that we put this in session law, and so that automatically expires at the end of 2 years. Okay, well then, Senate File 1563 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much. And now we'll move on to Senator Roebling, and I understand we're going to find these next two items on the agenda and welcome Ms. Grimes and Mr. Metzen or Mr. Misakonis, whoever is coming up. Oh, yeah, right. And what?
I've met you before.
Oh, it's not. This is not. Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to start out by offering an author's amendment. It's a delete all amendment. It's the 809-0288.
Senator Roebling moves the 809-0288 amendment. All those in
wait,
yes.
Could I incorporate? There's a couple of little numbers that we would like to correct on here. On line 1.24, in the last column, it should have $1,418,158,000.
All right, we'll incorporate that on line 1.24.
And then on page 6. There is one more number like that. On 6.6, where it says 8, it should say 6. So it would be $3,466,000.
Okay, Senator Roebling will incorporate that in her motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The delete all amendment is, of course, quite different than the original bill. And we probably have heard quite a bit about it as the governor's supplemental budget came out. And he did make a great use of the federal stabilization funds for higher education. In fact, there's $392 million that money is in this bill. That's 59% of the $667 million in the federal stabilization funds for Minnesota for education. So he's giving it a generous portion of the federal dollars. It ended up bringing back the level of institutional aid, which had sustained a pretty significant cut in the original bill, to back to 2008 budget figures. And it also, because of the federal money, gave us a big boost in the state grant program. And as we were hearing from some of the previous bills, even Senator Clark's bill, for example, the living and miscellaneous expense allowance is going up 6% in this proposal. And then the grant for the two-year students is going up 7.5%, as well as for the four-year students is 7.5%. And going back to Senator Scoy's bill, he was trying to get the cap closer to the University of Minnesota's tuition level, and this could do it if it were today. But if there is a tuition increase, as we expect there might be for the University of Minnesota, it might not quite keep up. But it's closer, much closer than it has been the last year or two. And so those are some of the things we're looking at in the grant. As I mentioned, the institutional aid is at 2008 levels, and I'll let Ms. Grimes explain that in a minute, how he brought that down to 2006 levels, because that was the minimum amount that we had to have, and then backfilled it with the federal stabilization dollars to the level that we're at now. There's several programs that didn't receive any cuts, but there's still cuts in the bill. The Safety Officer Survivors Program and the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership are funded at today's dollars. Programs with 5% budget cuts are the state Work Study Program, the Child Care Grants, the Minnesota American Indian Scholarships, the Midwest Higher Education Compact, and the Outreach for Student and Parent Information. There's also some 10% cuts. Some of these we've had bills before us on, Minitex, the MinLink Gateway, the Learning Network of Minnesota, Intervention for College Attendance Program Grants, the United Family Medicine Residency Program, the campus Compact, which we just heard today, Agency Administration, which is Office of Higher Education, and then there's some with even with larger reductions. The Minnesota College Savings Plan matching grants has a 31% reduction, but a lot of this is projected to be unspent, so it's a natural area to cut. And the Achieve program, some of which has been unspent as well, is taking a significant cut. It is $5.45 million in the next year and $5.5 million in the following 2011. And then there is some money that also is redirected in that grant program for online education. So if students in high school, as it is set up now, the Achieve program, we're trying to get students to take appropriate courses so that they are ready for college. And if they do, they can attain this $1,200 scholarship to be used for their first two semesters. It's $600 for each of their first two semesters of college. The governor is proposing that we add to that another $150, so it would be $750 for taking online courses while they're still in high school as an incentive to encourage them to try that method. And quite frankly, they could be sort of a concurrent enrollment type of course. They could be taking a college course while getting credit for their high school requirements as well. Otherwise, those are sort of the highlights and lowlights of the proposal. And I think for the significant detail, I will turn to our staff from the Office of Higher Education.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Mark Michikanis with the Office of Higher Education. Senator Roebling has actually summarized things very succinctly. I'm curious how you wanted to proceed. If you get some direction, it might be. There's some language things in here we can discuss, if that's helpful.
Why don't you go over the language stuff?
That's in Article 2. I believe it's starting on page 9 of the amendment.
Okay.
Madam Chair, before we get to that, Ms. Grimes reminds me, in both the University of Minnesota and the Minsky sections, there is some language that I wanted to point out to you. Find it quickly here. Well, for the Board of Regents, this is starting on page 6, the top of page 7. If we have working from the same documents, we may not be. I have an earlier copy, but this is.
It's on.
Madam Chair.
6. Why are you talking about the tuition?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, that's 6.1 to 6.5 for Minsky and 7.6.
6 and 7.9. Yeah, it is the same.
Okay.
Just to point out that the governor has mentioned this in a number of. When he revealed the supplemental budget and earlier on about tuition limitations, the whole point is not to in any way restrict the boards. The decision-making is up to them, both for Minsky and the Board of Regents, but to indicate that there is a lot of concern about tuition increases and to the extent that the increases can be mitigated, the impact on students, that should be the number one priority.
What's the rationale for giving more of the federal money to the U than to Minsky?
Madam Chair, there was actually no choice. In order to follow the federal language, it had to be tied to the 2008 fiscal year highest number and bring it up to that level. And it just happened to be that the University of Minnesota had a higher number.
Had a higher number that year.
That year, in part because of some money that was allocated for the Male Partnership.
Do you have a question?
I did. There are a couple of provisions in here that are tied to healthcare access fund dollars, and I wanted to know if this is typically how these funds are allocated within this division or if this is something new. So that is, do we typically see healthcare access fund dollars utilized in the higher ed division, or is this something new?
Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, this is an appropriation that has been in the bill for a number of years. It's the same amount ongoing for the same purpose.
What's the purpose? Medical education?
Yeah, primary care.
Madam Chair. And
it's for medical education.
And Mr. Albrecht. And so let me further clarify then. So during the last biennium, did we fund those measures with that mechanism?
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, yes.
Thank you.
And Mr. Michikanis, is the governor cutting the health care access funding in the higher education bill?
Madam Chair, no, he is not. And if I may elaborate for Senator Lynch, I believe the appropriation to the University of Minnesota dates back to the early 90s almost, when the Healthcare Access Fund was first established. This number was $400,000 higher, probably in 2003, and it was reduced back then. This bill does not, or the recommendations does not reduce it any further. It was $2.1 million back then, and it continues to be.
And this wasn't the fund that was unallotted by the governor. That was Merck, right?
It was Merck.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to comment, some of our other committees, when we're looking over the cuts and the funds and the funding proposals, we have a chart that has the current funding year and then the proposal, and that helps me keep things in context, because right now, you know, when you're going
too.
Up, down 5%,
that?
Down 10%, down 31%, it's hard to figure out where we are. Could we get something from the department that lays out the current budget and the proposals?
Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, there is a spreadsheet that Mr. Lombrick has prepared, and we could have copies made of that. It's printed pretty small, but if you have reading glasses, you'll be okay.
As long as it's all one page, Senator.
It is
all right,
on
we'll
one
get it
page.
Printed.
I did want to point out that that the university specials, a lot of them have stayed at current levels. The Ag and Extension Service stayed at current levels. Health Sciences, the Institute of Technology, the system specials. And then the University of Minnesota and Mayo Foundation Biotechnology and Medical Genomics Partnership. And then bovine tuberculosis research. The Mayo Clinic, however, did go down 10%. It's losing $125,000 each year in the governor's proposal.
But the partnership stays the same?
Pardon?
The partnership dollars, I think that's $8
million
right. a year? $16 million stays the same?
The partnership's the same. I failed to mention there is, besides new money in the grant program, we had one other additional increase, and that was for the tuition reciprocity. It's particularly for North Dakota schools, because we have more students going there, so we're increasing that $1 million to cover those additional students that are going from Minnesota to North Dakota schools.
It's $1 million a year? Mr. Michikanis, was there any other language? I know that you didn't have a lot of language this year, but
Madam Chair,
Ms. Grimes,
the committee talked about most of this language in your last meeting, I believe, when we looked at the agency policy bill. There's an amendment in the post-secondary textbook legislation, which I've worked with Mr. Fuller on. That part of it really needs to be as part of session law rather than statutory law. So he's got a little bit of a change to recommend in that. On the definition of Minnesota resident for purposes of tuition reciprocity, it's a technical change. It just replaces language that was repealed in another place. Then there's the governor's recommended language on increasing achieve scholarships for high school students who take online courses. And the one thing we didn't mention before, I don't think, was sections 5 and 6, which is called moral obligation language for self student loans. This is patterned after language the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has. It would provide a moral obligation as a backup for tax-exempt revenue bonds issued for student loans under our SELF program, the student loan program. In the event pledged revenues were not enough to pay bondholders, the governor would be obliged to ask the legislature to appropriate money to pay the bondholders. We think that's an extremely unlikely event because we do have to set aside large reserves as a part of each bond sale. The language is needed to improve the ability to sell bonds for the self-loan program at reasonable interest rates. And like I said, it's very similar to existing statutory language that the Housing Finance Agency has.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, what's the range of possible exposure on that provision in case, I mean, what's the maximum shortfall that we may be incurring a moral obligation for?
Madam Mr. Chair, and to the members, I would suggest exposure is near zero. Our default rate just on the student loan side is, on the net basis, is less than 1%. We'd have to essentially have all the students default before we couldn't pay things back. And on top of that, we're required both under our letter of credit and our insurance company that still has insurance on our outstanding bonds to keep excess reserves in place of up to 10% over our liabilities. So there's a substantial amount of cash available. And, Madam Chair, this is only – the governor only would make a request to the legislature. It doesn't have to be funded.
Happen. Okay. Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair, then why do we need the language if there's no risk of default and it only possibly goes into a budget?
Madam Chair, it's an interesting question. And this comes from our bond rating agencies and our investment bankers that tell us that the rating agencies like this because it gives them another level of comfort. And also that when it comes to having conversations with the bond insurance companies, it puts us in a different bucket, if you will, when people were talking to. We had this problem over the last 6-8 months as we dealt with refinancing the self-loan program, where if we had had this language in place at that point in time, we would have been dealing with different people in the banks, and we would have been dealing with people in the banks with more money. So it's simply the way we're being treated by banks and the rating agencies that improves with this language. And I, to the extent that they feel comfortable by that, I'm not sure why, but they tend to.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, different topic. I think I recall in the stimulus money that there's money allocated for loan forgiveness in some health-related areas, and I'm not sure if that falls in this division or if that falls in the Health and Human Services division.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Grimes.
In Minnesota, health loan forgiveness has been handled in the health department. There, many years ago, it was at our agency, but it was transferred at one point to the health department. And I believe that that is where that is currently being considered now. That's my understanding, anyway.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Senator Lynch.
I think we should get some concrete clarification on that because I think that's a really important initiative that Minnesota wants to be a part of, and I've asked, frankly, in both divisions and kind of got the same answer. Kind of, it's not clear. And so I would ask that the agency confirm and clarify that
for
us.
Yeah, we have considered loan forgiveness bills, but because they have experience in administering them in the health department and they have kind of a long history of doing it, we've preferred to have them continue doing that rather than have the Office of Higher Education start it up.
Madam Chair.
We'll get that clarified.
Yeah, I don't care who does it. Yeah. I just am concerned that we might miss the boat.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, you raise a good question.
Thank you.
Okay. I had a question about we have been funding these family practice residency programs, and I see the governor is cutting United Family Practice. Does he cut all the other programs? Because I've been concerned about kind of being parity between all the programs.
Madam Chair, to the extent that they're part of the Mayo appropriation, I assume that they would have to take that into consideration. And likewise, the St. Cloud program and the other at the University of Minnesota. Now, the St. Cloud program actually
that's
part of a special, I believe. That wasn't reduced. I'd have to.
How do we fund
Mr.
Albert
can confirm that.
Do we have a separate line item?
So it could be dealt with.
It's part of the University of Minnesota.
It's in the university section.
It's part of the university section. Okay, specifically. But could the university reduce it?
No.
Okay, well, we may have to look at those just to make sure if we, everybody has to share in the cut equally. Why do you think that the Minnesota College Savings Program is still so underprescribed? Ms. Grimes?
Chair, you know, we made this change 2 years ago to increase the both the reimbursement rate and
right.
percentages with the thought that it would encourage more savings. We just struggle with people with low income saving money for students.
Because it's such a low income thing. And
certainly the savings is large. There's $600 million of assets in the savings plan, but it tends to be grandparents and other people like that.
Uh-huh.
This, of course, is directed to low income family saving.
So that's different than what some of the federal college savings programs are. They're not so restricted in terms of income? Or they just have tax advantages?
It's the tax advantages.
Okay.
Although I'm a little bit confused about the distinction in your question. I mean,
I guess I'm not really remembering how the college savings program works. So maybe you need to refresh my memory.
Madam Chair, all 50 states have college savings plans under what's known as 529 of the IRS tax code, so they get called 529 plans. And all of them have a federal tax advantage in that the interest on them accumulates without incurring income tax liability as long as the proceeds are eventually used to support a student's post-secondary education. In Minnesota, we have a matching grant program. If the income of the beneficiary's family is less than $50,000 a year, we match 15% of what the contribution is up to $400 a year. If your income is between $50,000 to $80,000, we match 10% up to $400 a year. Typically, however, when it comes to college savings plans, the families that use them tend to have incomes higher than $80,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are not a lot of families that are currently using the matching grant program. We do try to market that and increase that to the extent we can. But by and large, when it comes to putting away money for what might be 10 to 20 years away, low-income families are not as able to do it.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, and this just a comment. In the area of work study, I think, received a 5% cut, and I just, I think that's disappointing. I think we all share that we're concerned about students' ability to be able to afford college, and I would hope that we could find a way to enable them to have this be a component there.
Senator Roebling, I mean, we kind of consider that part of financial aid. I've relumped all those together, so it's not just the state grant, but all of our financial aid programs. So all the ways in which we help students, I think, need to be considered equally. Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, even though the 5% cut, and this is Ms. Grimes has put together here, right now there's about 11,000 students who earn an average of $1,700 working in state work study jobs. And the reduction is about 500 fewer jobs at that average. But in the Federal American Recovery Act, it's estimated that the Minnesota campuses will receive an increase of about 10% each year in federal work study funds that would create about 1,500 additional jobs. So we'll actually gain 1,000 jobs even if we are cutting from our appropriation 500 jobs or the money for 500 jobs.
Okay.
So we're still gaining.
Okay. That's good. That's good information. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, on line 838.32, I wonder if you would consider an amendment which our legal counsel has gotten used to in the Energy Committee. and after chairs put and the ranking minority members.
Mr. Fuller, where should that go?
Line 8.32.
Senator Sinjum said 8.32 after chairs.
After chairs, okay. Mm-hmm. Insert, repeat that then, Senator Sinjum.
After chairs, insert and the ranking minority members.
I would consider that a friendly amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Sinjum moves the amendment on page 8, line 32, after chairs, insert, and the ranking minority members. All those in favor?